The Vietnam War, it's over. Your job just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Hello and welcome to Victory Points. I'm Becca Scott.
And I'm Jake Michaels.
And this is a podcast about people who love tabletop games interviewing other people who love tabletop games about the tabletop games they love. Woo-hoo. Right, Jake?
It is. That's correct. You got it right.
Thank you. I was reading. Today.
Have you ever forgotten what this podcast is?
All the time.
Okay. Got me confused with another podcast that you do.
Shh, we haven't introduced you yet.
Who was that guy?
That guy was Patrick Capera. He's our guest today.
Hello.
Did Hi. I say your last name correctly?
You did.
Yes. Okay. Always important. Patrick is a published game developer and writer. He's worked on over 30 titles of his own creation, probably 30 more as a freelance writer and editor. He's the co-founder of Crafty Games, created the award-winning Spycraft brand, which is an RPG game, and has published Brandon Sanderson's Mistborn House Wars game with Crafty, and nominated for a Diana Jones Award in Gaming Excellence. A busy guy, plays a lot of games. Welcome, Patrick.
Hi, thanks for having me.
That's a good little resume.
One thing I forgot to mention, you worked for AEG for many, many years.
I did, from 98 to 2005, yeah.
Oh, wow, that is many years.
Yeah.
And you
Far
started
in the
there
past, though.
As a writer?
I started there as an editor. Actually, okay. I started as an intern. And they brought me on for a three-month stint, and by the end of my 3 months, I had a couple cover credits. And they're like, okay, maybe we should hire him as a writer.
Cool.
So I wound up staying on with them as a writer for a few years before they elevated me to brand manager.
Right
so,
on.
Yeah.
And you said, about time. Come on, Alderaan Entertainment Group.
Oh, they were wonderful to work for.
Yeah. So. But then you branched out and started your own publishing company, Crafty Games. Mm-hmm. So how did that come about?
AEG went through a restructuring in 2005. They were primarily collectible card games and role-playing games at the time and heavy IP building. And they transformed into the board game company that they are today. But that took years. Right at the beginning of that, they went through a period where they were trying to figure out where the company was going to go and where everyone was going to fall. And I had actually gone on sabbatical a few months earlier. And so I come back from sabbatical and suddenly the company is like a sliver of its former size because they condensed down just to get to the core of what they wanted. And I was like, whoa, what's going on?
Where am I?
Exactly. So I called up John Zinzer and asked him what was going on. He explained it was really good. And we parted on great terms because at the time there just was not a place for me at the company. And he's like, well, just call me up if you ever need anything. And so my freelancers and I were talking about Spycraft not long after that. And we had wanted to continue it. And Spycraft was one of the brands that had been spun off into sort of, you know, development non-existence by this restructuring.
Sure. Let's hold in. Tell us, what is Spycraft?
Yeah, yeah.
Spycraft is a game that I created in 2001. It was published in 2002. It's had two editions. It's a role-playing game for now. It's an espionage, modern espionage themed action RPG that originally started built on the D20 system, but it's gradually moved further and further away from that and acquired sort of its own identity. It's sort of team based James Bond is the best way to Mission Impossible style play.
Now, were there a lot of RPGs really breaking the mold of what D&D had set at that point? Because now, of course, there definitely are.
It was a very busy time. Everybody was like, there were post-apoc hacks for D20. There were modern hacks for it. There were everything under the sun.
So to clarify that, just to make sure for everybody's on the same page on this, you're talking about the D20 system that was largely what was based around third edition D&D,
third edition,
right?
D&D,
and then when you say hacks, it's like homemade mods or published mods.
Published mods.
Yeah. That modified that system to fit into a world or an open source world, right?
Right. So it's a really long time ago now. So people have sort of forgotten, but the D20 license... D20 game, third edition, launched with an open game license that allowed anyone to publish anything inside the D20 moniker. And it was originally intended for people to create adventures and extra magic items and new monsters for D&D. But they hadn't really considered that people would branch out and start, at least that's the impression I got. They did, at the time, it seemed like they were sort of scrambling to figure out how to define what that license was allowed to do. And the way the license was actually set up, people were able to essentially do D&D offshoots that weren't D&D at all.
And used all that foundational work they'd done to then create a system of their own publishing, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, so fascinating.
And do it professionally.
I think you're right. I don't think they intended that at all. And that was just a side effect
of it. Happy accident for everyone else.
We got lucky because we were sort of officially endorsed because Zinzer was friends with everybody at Wizards, of course, because they owned L5R for a really long time.
Legend of the Five Rings.
Exactly. Yeah. And so we'd all worked on that game. We were still working on that game for Wizards. And so we wound up getting licensed to use some of the Star Wars stuff that was also based on D20. So we were sort of semi-legitimized by that a little bit more than a lot of companies.
Super legit.
A lot of games were. So yeah, that was really cool.
Yeah.
That's great.
Amazing. So that's how
Spycraft.
God, I wanted Starcraft to say Starcraft. I was like, that's not
different
it.
Game.
You didn't create Starcraft. Spycraft came about. So it's early. It's early, listeners. It's early here.
Starcraft, the RPG, was one of the first RPG systems I designed in a notebook myself that never got published because it was, you know.
Oh, you designed the StarCraft RPG?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
The one that
by
never,
Jake Michaels.
That doesn't exist. Yeah. It's in my notebook somewhere.
Designed by 10-year-old Jake Michaels.
Yeah, he was like 14. Yeah, okay.
You have to get me a copy of that at some point.
Yeah, sure. It's a mess.
You gotta find it.
Yeah, exactly.
So was that your first real... You'd done a lot of world building in games before that, yeah?
Yeah. Well, before that, before Spycraft launched, I'd worked on Legend of the Burning Sands, which was an offshoot of Legend of the Five Rings, sort of an Arabian Nights style card game. And I was the story lead for that. And when that ended, they moved me over to Doomtown, and I took over the second story of Doomtown. And I worked a little bit on L5R with Risosvi and everybody else in the background.
Doomtown is based on Deadlands. Deadlands, yeah. Card game, right?
RPG.
And then one of them was a card game, though, wasn't it?
Doomtown.
Okay, Doomtown was the card game.
Doomtown was the card game, yeah.
So you have a long history in card games specifically.
That's what as you say, that's mostly world building. At least for me. There was a design team that managed all the mechanics, and I worked directly with them, and occasionally I would throw an idea into the mix, but usually I stayed out of that. And they would give me sort of a raw pile of mechanics for an expansion, like, this works, we're happy with it, go flavor it, and then I would figure out how to write a story around
that. Oh, cool.
That. Yeah.
That's a great job.
Yeah, it was pretty cool.
Yeah, so they'd present you with the mechanics.
Right, exactly, and I'd skin them, essentially.
Yeah.
I'd come up with all the art descriptions and all the flavor text and write fiction that was sort of tying them together and, come up with tournament ideas, things like that.
So when you were young, before you even knew you would be a game designer, or I don't know if you were born with that idea, did you have a background in writing specifically, or what was your background in that led you to that position?
I always wrote, and I always wrote creatively, but I wasn't trained professionally to do it. I actually...
Even better, who needs it? If you have good ideas, you don't need someone to tell you your ideas are good.
Well, everybody who winds up like training in it winds up going off to do something else. Like, hey, I'm trained as a creative writer, but I'm a pharmacist now. Or it's bizarre.
It's like having a degree in art history or theater performance.
Theater.
A Bachelor of Arts from University of Missouri, Kansas City. No big deal. Do you want to see it? I have it right here, framed.
I have it. I have mine framed, and it's just sitting on the floor where I will never put it up on. I'll never put that on the wall.
I like to frame my floor.
An English degree.
I cover my floor with frames. Is that not normal?
No, it's normal because I have it in my house too. We need to hang that up.
Cover your floor with frames?
Not cover. Just that's where they get stored.
Oh, that's
like
where
to decorate so people know where to
where
walk.
Where they get passed? Yeah. Yes. Okay. Got it.
You get it. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. All right. So what were games that got you into gaming?
Let's see. I started actually playing AD&D First Edition. That was the very first thing I ever played.
Ooh, First Edition.
First Edition, yeah.
Cutting Edge, ground floor.
Well, Redbox and everything came well before that. And I wound up actually going back and playing Redbox after. But AD&D was sort of the...
You know you've been in it since the beginning when you, like, clarify that Redbox came before how old you are.
No, I'm just
like,
a grognard now.
Yeah, I know, yeah. But you are. That's what I'm saying. It's like, that's so specific and true, but, like, you're old school. Let's admit it. Like,
I am old school.
Because we are, too.
But I wasn't playing Redbox when it hit, is my point.
Yeah, I'm
not
going to
make
school.
That claim.
Yeah, that's so. True. You're new school. I've been playing since AD&D as well. That's true.
Yeah, so I started with that, and then I played a bunch of stuff. Cyworld, Shadowrun, Cyberpunk.
Shadowrun.
Yeah. Oh, nice.
I love Shadowrun.
Yeah. Shadowrun gets some love.
Does
especially
it still?
Shout out to Saving Throw Show, our buddies over there. They've done some Shadowrun campaigns.
And there's actually some video games that still come out. It's still a living franchise out there. I always loved that. That was
Sixth
a really
edition
fun
just announced, thing. Just launched at Gen Con.
Is it, how is it?
I haven't played it, but it looks great.
Is it a thinner book this time? Because
it's
I feel
more streamlined,
like
and they figured out how to make their hackers sort of simultaneous with the rest of the team.
Great, instead
the
of existing in super speed or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, that game was so cool, but they just had so many subsystems in terms of like every possibility of physics. It was just so much burden to learn.
Yeah, some of the D6 pool mini game things that would happen. Yeah,
they were fun, but they were work. They were arithmetic.
It was a lot of work. It wasn't Hero by any means, but it was up there.
All right. Transitioning from old school RPGs I've never played. I would love to talk more about Mistborn House War. Mm-hmm. This is a game we played on Game the Game almost 2 years
ago
now. And I want to start with talking about Mistborn, the trilogy by Brandon Sanderson, because I'm a big fan and I want to nerd out about that for a minute. So you could become a head of the Great House of Luthadel in this game. So it is a dystopian world where these great lords overrule all of the peasant class. Oh man, I've forgotten all of my terminology. And there are these people who have powers, and your power is enacted by swallowing a vial of metal and burning it from within yourself to do whatever your one ability is. Like you could be a steel pusher or like an iron puller. No, iron is probably related to emotions, but you have one connection to one type of metal that gives you one specific power.
Right. And it either pushes or pulls.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know more. Go on.
So in the world, Brandon's novels are all defined by their magic systems. Mm. He's got one based on light. He's got ones based on a number of different things. This one, as you say, it's about the chemical properties of metal and what happens when you ingest them and then burn them in your system, but
yes,
only if you're a specific type of
person. I love technical magic. I love when it's quantified. I want to know how it works.
Yeah, exactly. And this one's deep. It's got 20 some odd different effects, different metals that you can burn, and there are pushing metals and pulling metals. And
well, it starts with just eight. Don't get crazy.
Yeah, it's true.
Eight that you know about in the first book.
We're a little deep into it now, so I forget that there was a period where it was just this small. Yeah. So the whole pushing and pulling thing is interesting because, for example, there are two metals, one of which pushes emotions and one of which pulls emotions. And so the way that will work
like
is
a rioter and a
soother.
A soother, yes.
Yeah. So for example, you could either riot someone to inflame their emotions and get them angry at the opportune moment. Or you could do the exact opposite and calm them down.
And by push and pull, you guys mean like endow them with that emotion or take that emotion away?
So yes. Sort of. It's all pushing or pulling away from you. But it is ultimately having the effect you're describing, is like I'm pulling it out of you toward me.
Got it.
Pushing it from
me
into
you. So it's a transference of sorts.
Exactly.
Okay.
And
understood.
That's the sort of metaphorical pushing and pulling. There's also literal pushing and pulling of metals, which enables characters to fly.
Okay.
But
sort
only
of fly.
If you are Mistborn.
Yeah. You can, so you Mistborn can steel means... push by pushing off of metal pieces.
So you basically like pole vault with the energy within you.
It's like stilt walking.
Yeah. Any emotion of your choice? Like, do you choose emotion or?
No, this is
moving on from emotion now.
Oh, now we're into physics.
So if you are a Mistborn, you have access to burning all of the metals. So you can both push and pull emotions. You can both push and pull on steel. So the way that you can fly is kind of a combination of pole vaulting to push away and like Spider-Man web slinging to pull.
Exactly.
And the combination of that, if there's enough metal, like even, you know, part of a steel building or pushing against... A nail sitting on the floor across the room.
Throw a coin on the ground and push off of it, sort of thing.
Sure, absolutely.
So
that's cool.
What do they call a coin shot?
Basically
a mercenary that will kill you by shooting a coin through your head.
What? Yeah, they throw up in the air and then shove it through the air at you like a projectile.
So basically, it's a very well thought out, very just brilliant world. Vin is the protagonist of the first book, The Final Empire. Well, all three of the first trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
And she is one of the few Mistborn and is taken in by Kelsier, the head of this sort of den of thieves where he has a collection of all types of metal burners that want to uprise against the corrupt government.
This is the basic pitch for the first novel. It's essentially Ocean's 13 meets Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Love that. So,
yeah. Well, the game itself kind of plays that out, right?
So it plays out, you are essentially the bad guys.
Yeah.
So we started with an RPG that does play out the way that you expect. There's you build a crew, you come up with what the crew's trying to accomplish in the world, and the GM, it's sort of a narrative discourse game, a little bit like Fate in terms of complexity and mechanics. It uses its own system, but it's very similar. And when we built the board game, everybody sort of expected us to go with the heroes again. And we were talking to Kevin Wilson, who co-created Spycraft with me. And he's like, you know, I've always wanted to do a negotiation game. And that started a conversation where we wound up on this idea of the players sitting down as the leaders of the noble houses who are essentially running the dystopian empire for the big bad whose name is the Lord Ruler.
Who is all powerful. That's why it's called the Final Empire, because, he's going to live forever, so you don't need anybody after. Final Empire, no problem. Lord Ruler.
Yeah,
whatever.
That's what's actually cool about kind of the level that these people are at, is that they are the high houses, so they have all the power in the city, except the god that sits right above them.
Yes, and he's essentially the one doling out the victory points throughout the game, although he's never actually a component there. He's not
his
at the table.
Felt.
He's not a player.
So we have negotiation. Explain to me a little bit more about how this game is played, because you'll do a better job than I could. A minute.
Everybody controls a house. The house gets a number of resources. There are 6 resources in the game, 5 basic resources like warriors or food or money, and a 6th resource called adium, which is the magic metal in the setting. It's essentially the anything metal.
Got to get that ATM.
Yeah, and in the story of the novels, the adium is stockpiled by noble houses as a sort of super currency. But in our game, it operates as a wild that you can use in place of anything else. So that you have all these resources, and there are all these problems that are coming across the board. And
they're literally called problems, aren't they?
They are. they're called problem cards, yeah.
We have a problem card.
And those actually show up essentially because of what's happening in the novels. The characters in the novels are causing problems and attempting to disrupt the empire.
So yeah, as the rebels start to overthrow things, the houses have to respond, right?
Exactly.
By committing these resources to doing so.
Right.
And then they negotiate with other houses to split the reward?
Yeah, well, the trick is that in most cases, you're not going to be able to solve a problem on your own.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to actually work with multiple people at the table. And doing that sort of forces you into a position where someone has to take a certain amount of credit for solving the problem for the Lord Ruler, who's going to be pleased if the problem is solved. And so the negotiation is twofold. On the one hand, it's how much can I leverage of what I've got and still maintain more throughout the rest of the game. And then on the other side, it's how much for favor of the Lord Rulers, which is victory points, can I curry out of this?
Yes.
And then just add extra complications. We've got personality cards that you, they're people you hire that you play, and they come in and change things.
The major complication of the game that you haven't mentioned yet is the end condition in terms of like who wins and loses depending where the battle.
Yes.
Right.
You can align.
Rulers, favor doesn't matter if the Empire falls, right?
Yeah.
So
that's a crazy idea. I love that idea.
Yeah. Kevin was, this was where he started. He wanted the mutually exclusive victory condition, and he built the rest of the game sort of around it.
Alternate win conditions are always a fun time. I'm all about it.
Yeah, this one's really exciting because what it does is either the unrest track is going to have Kelsier get to the end of the unrest track. You've got to figure
who's the leader of this sort of rebellion. So if he is successful in overthrowing the Lord Ruler, then you want to be on Kelsier's side.
Yeah, you want to be away from the Lord Ruler, which means you actually want the lowest score possible. And since the game sort of is built to get the highest score possible in its basic play pattern, it disrupts it because you start playing and you realize, well, wait a minute, I don't know, I'm not going to know for a while yet whether the Empire will actually survive this game, so I can't really run my score all the way up. So you wind up sort of playing the middle point. And sometimes you collect disgrace on purpose.
Sure.
Let your house be shamed just so that you're not quite so close to the Lord Ruler and things like that.
So. Absolutely. So my instinct when I play a game like this is to always go for the alternate win condition.
Yeah,
but
it
then
is.
You sort of need to be the only one doing that, right?
Well, but if you're the only one, it may not happen because you may not be able to force the unrest track high enough.
So is the ideal that people sort of split up half and half?
I don't know that there is an ideal. We found that there have been pretty successful games where it's one on many, and pretty successful games that work half and half. So that's what we're pretty pleased with the balance on that side.
Yeah,
it doesn't necessarily fall into a particular path.
Yeah, I think all my playthroughs have been pretty balanced, which is difficult with an alternate win condition being available.
And especially when the driving force in the game isn't a mechanic, it's the players themselves, because you can't really predict what they're going to do.
Yes. So. People be unpredictable.
Yeah.
All right. I want to talk a little bit about negotiation games in general and your feelings about them, because I love a good negotiation game. But depending on the players you have at the table, you may be able to manipulate certain people more than others, especially if they're more of a casual gamer that is a very nice person. What do you do in those situations where you know you could take advantage of the newer player at the table in a negotiation kind of game?
Oh, God. I will freely admit, this is one place where Mistborn's not quite as friendly to the new gamer in some respects, because it's a shark's pit, right?
That's all right. You listen, this is a podcast for gamers. So
it's a little bit more difficult to say, hey, new person who's kind of shy and hasn't really come out of their shell yet with board gaming in general, come play this game where everybody is nasty to each other and betrays each other on a regular basis.
Well, you know, that's Luthadel.
Yeah. But personally, I would probably wind up allying with that person pretty early on, just to try and help them, help them through, just through example, if nothing else, right?
Even if you take a fall.
Oh,
I mean,
absolutely.
I know games are about the friendships we make.
Yeah, let the Wookiee win when you're demoing
nice.
A game, right? But
but it's the context too of what you set up, though. You brought a person in for their first version of Mistborn. You want them to know that this is part of the game. Part of the game is betrayal. Part of the game is taking advantage as much as you can of those alliances, right? Mm-hmm. So they should know. If they come in knowing that, then you feel a little bit better of quote unquote taking advantage, because you're not taking advantage of their newness, because you set them up, right?
Well, the single best thing I think you could do in that situation is to set up a scenario where they're the one who gets to do the betraying, and actually get advantage of someone else. Because then, hopefully they own that, right? And then they can start moving through the game at their own pace embracing it on their own terms.
Yeah, I'm always pleasantly surprised when playing a social deduction game. And I was playing with a housemate who is pretty new to games. Now she's a hardcore gamer.
and
a cousin who, this was at Thanksgiving, and she's like 10 years older than me, and she casually games, but she's a lawyer. She has the sweetest voice and like straightest face, and she got me so good. She was definitely on the side of the resistance, but she was so like when a new gamer is able to lie very well, and that's not negotiation, that's social deduction, but
they're very similar. There's a lot
of
overlap.
But there is that very much up off the table kind of element of both of those mechanics.
There's still deception in either way, right?
Yes. Yeah. But Jake, I want you to speak a little more about negotiation, because you are the master of, in Twilight Imperium,
what's that?
Casually getting everyone on your side, and then you just win every time because you are the one who's explaining the rules. You very much come in as the authority, so therefore we all trust you and always trade with only you. How do you do that?
I wouldn't say that you're gaming. I'm not. Well, I try not to be. I have this reputation. So, like, I was literally thinking about this morning. It's really interesting you brought this up. The thing is that I have a reputation for doing just that, which is making a lot of deals and like people later in the game seeing how my deals have chained up into something like they didn't expect. Mm-hmm. And so I actually just played a game of Twilight Imperium about 3 weeks ago with four of the five other players I had never played with before.
At not Gen Con? What's it called?
At Gen Can't.
Gen Can't.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Sorry, three of the players I never played with before. But before I got there, our good mutual friend Ruel told them to be mindful of working with Jake. He set up a pretext of like, he will make deals with you, but I don't think the words wolf in sheep's clothing were said, but man, that's the reputation I had. Like, they shook my hand when I first met him and they were all very nice, but then like an hour in, they're like, well, Ruel told us about you. I was like,
what? Ooh.
And that game went pretty far, and I was actually very much in a bad position for most of it. I was still like in it. I was back midway, and then towards the very end, I had a shot at winning, and Ruel threw up his hands. He's like, how did you do this? In the end, I did not win.
Well,
but here's... Oh, go ahead.
Oh, no, I had a follow-up question. Finish your... You go.
Well, I was going to say, like, my true, honest thing, I don't try to really take advantage of anybody. I really don't. What I actively try to do is look for deals that will benefit my person I'm dealing with, because if they honestly see a benefit, then they'll honestly try to give me what I want.
Yeah, but you're the one that always is looking for the deal that will benefit versus focusing on what's right in front of you.
Yes,
right.
Now sometimes they have leverage over me, or I have leverage over them, depending on our position. That's just negotiation.
That's just life, you know.
Yeah,
that's
but I'm a
greater scheme of things.
I'm aggressive for helping people get what they want in return for something that they don't value now, but I will value later.
Right. Right.
Okay, this brings up another topic for me, which is playing with the handicap of people having preconceived notions of you as a gamer.
Before we do, we should probably take a break. Should we lead that into a break?
Cliffhanger. We'll be right back after this break. And we're back to Victory Points. I'm Becca Scott. That's Jake Michaels. And our guest is Patrick Capera.
Hey, yo.
So when we last left us, we were discussing what it's like for people who are brilliant, excellent, win all the time gamers like the three of us, and how we deal with sitting down to a table and someone saying, don't trust them, they're really good at games.
Conversely, we're also talking about maybe the host of a game night. So maybe you, as a listener, are the person who's hosting, and so everybody knows that you're the guy or the girl who has the game.
Yeah.
Thank you for questioning your default.
Yeah, you're the person who has the game, so therefore you know the rules and therefore are pretty safe to go against because they're going to probably have an quote-unquote advantage.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a fair thing to think, I think. But we don't want us to always be the target, right?
Yeah. Well, how do you deal with this, Patrick? Because I assume you're quite a gamer. I'm sure there are situations you've been in that are similar.
There are. So, well, I don't play a lot of board games with strangers.
I have seen you at booths, sir, and I don't believe you.
Called out.
Okay, I demo a lot of games to strangers, but okay. Demoing is very, very different because in those cases, I'm more focused on showcasing what's cool than I am actually playing the game myself.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
And even if I'm there playing the game myself, I'm usually what I'm doing is I'm trying to find opportunities to say, here's this mechanic that is in the game that we haven't seen yet. How can I actually work it in?
Uh-huh.
So a lot of times I'll take turns that in retrospect don't seem like the best idea, But it let me play a personality card that I wouldn't have been able to showcase otherwise, or it let me show how a particular rule worked or something like that.
So that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, very, very different. When I'm playing games, I tend not to be overly competitive. Yeah.
not our bag.
Yeah, exactly.
Is that on this side purpose? Of the table,
yeah. I see,
because your default as someone that loves games, I assume, like anyone that loves games, winning feels good.
Well, winning does feel good, and I enjoy winning.
So you've had to teach yourself to be less competitive.
So my group tends to play co-ops, and we do that on purpose because, like, we all like winning together.
Yeah.
And oftentimes I am the host. Yeah, exactly.
I also think Becca's worldview might be changing a little bit. Like, you need to acknowledge that maybe not everybody experiences the games the same way that you do.
I will never acknowledge that.
he's flat out saying, like, winning's not the most important thing. And you're like, well, winning is the most important thing.
Sure.
The experience is actually, honestly, legitimately the most important thing for me.
Aww. Yeah. Wow, so. I say that all the time, but I don't mean it. You're a rare butterfly. Go on. You had other thoughts. So what would your advice fix me, Patrick?
I don't know that I am qualified to attempt to fix you, Becca.
I can try. How I am? Oh, okay.
I
mean, go ahead.
You and I experience this the same way, right?
Yeah.
Is that we're the authority figure when it comes to rules generally in our groups.
Yes. Therefore, as am I.
Yeah. So therefore, we are. Prone to being targeted because it's a safe thing. Most people who are tentative in their first game are pretty conservative about what they do. And so if they're going to take a risk, they're going to take it on the person who has the seeming advantage, right? Mm-hmm. I mean,
absolutely.
My suggestion is to go with it. Like,
my suggestion is try and play up that other person at the table that's the real threat.
Yes. Play the victim as well. Like, so in that game of Twilight Imperium, I actually had one of the worst starting positions. And on either side of me were also terrible starting positions.
He's just bragging nonstop about this game.
But I used that.
Yeah, we get it. You came from behind when everyone...
Was this the game you won?
No, it's a game I didn't win.
Okay,
but
right.
My point of that is that I had a disadvantage that I used as an advantage in that I told everybody how bad my position was.
Mm.
Therefore, I was perceived as less of a threat and therefore came in with a little bit of an advantage to a lot of negotiations because they didn't think giving me would benefit me much more. I wasn't already ahead.
Right. And they're still making the deal for themselves ultimately.
Right. So I'm not saying, like, be super whiny when people jump on you, but make them recognize that, oh, Becca's been debilitated. We don't have to pile on her more.
Sure, even
make
if you
them
are
pity in
you.
The game a
I
little
see
bit.
I see this manipulation tactic.
A little bit. Again, it's not manipulation. It's the truth of, like, oh, we really did gang up on her. Like, make them realize the truth.
Yeah. I think my feelings about it were when I started being that person at the table where people look to me for the rules and therefore look to me to be their first target.
Right.
At first it was like, hey, now that's not fair. That's mean. Stop it. Everybody stop beating up on me. And now I take it very much as a compliment.
As you should.
As an added challenge I have to work that much harder to come out ahead in the game. And it's like, oh, you up my difficulty level. That's fine.
Yeah.
No problem. I got this. And even if I don't win, it teaches me to lose more gracefully the more I lose.
That's a great attitude.
have you considered the... So you're saying that you're predominantly the host.
Always.
Definitely on her show where this happens a lot, too.
Also in my house. I love to host a game night.
Yeah, and you're predominantly the person who knows the rules.
This is true.
Have you considered taking the demo approach with your home game, where instead of making it about your position, you're constantly saying, well, this person is currently... Just educate everyone at the table about where this person is or that person is. Because if you do that, you're actually, it's all misdirection. You're taking all of the attention off yourself and suddenly people are thinking about this guy's got these resources or this person's planet could do these two things in the next couple of turns. It sort of puts all of the emphasis on the other side of the table, which might give you the freedom to do to play the game a little bit more liberally.
See, Patrick, You said you couldn't fix me, and yet here you have made me even more superpowered with this advice. Absolutely. I love that. Just be consciously aware of other people's board state and then I like to make sure people get complimented if they're doing something absolutely cool. You know, well, people love to feel good about
the authority
engine they
at the
set
table,
up.
Right? So it's like I can speak with authority about what this person has and what they're capable of.
Yeah.
So that backfires on me. It does, because people
think. Oh,
that's
cute that you got that going on.
Yeah, they think I'm being sarcastic, and I'm not. I'm like, I'm genuinely. Hey, nice move. You got 2 points. Like, fuck you, Jake.
Yeah.
I'm not. I know what you're
doing. Are you
quoting me? they accuse me of misdirection. They know
what. It does backfire sometimes. Yeah. And when it backfires. It does backfire,
but
kind of spitefully, unfortunately.
Yeah.
All right. I just wanted to give one thought, and I don't know where this quote, I can't remember where it came from now, but it's been really a guiding force whenever I'm kind of in a bad place or worried about how I'm coming off to people. I know that's not something everyone worries about, but when you're like trying to get in, make new friends or like get in with a new group, I wish I could remember where I first heard this, because it was someone important said this. I'll just say it now.
Yeah, say it first and maybe we'll find who it was.
The idea that people's perception of you mm-hmm. is based on how you make them feel about themselves. So in that sense, being a gracious gamer is really important for cultivating these friendships mm-hmm. and making sure that someone else is having a good time playing is going to make them feel better about you as a person off the gaming table.
Right.
Yeah. You know?
That's great. That's great. Yeah. I mean, that goes for all interactions, right? Of like, people only know you from their interactions with you. They don't know all of your history. And even if you tell it to them, they didn't experience it. Mm-hmm. So when you sit down at a table with someone and they see how you treat them, that's all they know about you personally and in the game world.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Anyway, just wanted to give that life advice.
Oh, no,
you're
I
welcome.
Love that. Well, I mean, yeah, have you been able to apply that in terms of?
Yeah, people love me.
That's what we were leading to.
Oh my gosh, I figured it out. It was Pete Buttigieg.
Oh.
I figured it out because I have
Mayor
phone notes
Pete.
That says words to live by.
Mm.
Yeah. Mayor Pete said that. Love Mayor Pete.
Well said.
Yeah. Good guy. My third choice for Democratic nominee for
Well, hopefully he's still in it by the time of this podcast.
Yeah.
He will be.
Yeah, that's
He'll be
very
still in it.
That's
it's
not
only,
very
yeah,
far away.
We're not that far ahead.
Unless we find out about all that
yeah.
dirty laundry Pete Buttigieg has.
Where are we?
We're in the United States of America in a primary season, Jake.
Yeah.
I wore my Bernie Sanders pants to yoga today. They have Bernie Sanders' face on them. But really, he's my second favorite primary candidate. I just have the pants from 2016. Anyway, should we talk about
are
games?
Are they like yoga pants? Like really
Yeah, they're leggings.
Got it.
They were a gift.
Where's his face?
I wanted
Everywhere.
To ask the question, but I didn't feel I could. Yeah,
No, it's all right. I'll ask it for you.
It's like a screen print of his face that is repeated in multiple colors. All over the legging.
Ah, got it. Okay.
So someone relaxing in yoga next to you while trying to get into meditative state opens their eyes and sees his face all over your legs?
It's beautiful. It's like a, you know, it's like an Andy Warhol kind of version of him, but a single color screen print. So it's not like you're just seeing an old man's face on a young woman's ass. It's...
Although that could have been a good sales tagline for the leggings.
Yeah, but they can be on anyone's ass.
Yeah.
Bernie Sanders belongs on everyone's ass, but Elizabeth Warren on your t-shirt, you know?
There it is.
No big deal. There, yeah. Shout out all three.
Sponsor of the show, Elizabeth Warren.
Oh my God, if we could get her to guess on this. No big deal.
She calls people every once in a while. I follow her on Instagram. I see it.
I saw that, and I immediately donated 3 separate times.
Do you answer all spam calls hoping that it's Elizabeth Warren?
I just received one as we were recording this podcast, and
you have to pick it up.
I got to pick it up.
I don't know her area
especially
code.
If it's Massachusetts.
Yeah, if it's a Massachusetts area code, you got to pick it up.
Okay.
You answer all phone calls with Elizabeth.
Okay, I'm going to start picking up unrecognized numbers, which I usually just let go to voicemail. I'm a call screeny kind of person because there's so much spam.
Yeah.
So many robocalls. But specifically about whether or not I want a loan. I don't want a loan. Anyway, now I'm going to answer them all. Elizabeth? Thank you for that. I gave you Pete Buttigieg. You gave me...
Hello, Elizabeth.
Okay. Patrick, new topic related to gaming once again.
Yeah.
So it's a couple weeks after Gen Con now,
yes,
and we'll be a couple more weeks after Gen Con when this goes out to listeners. But I want to talk about your experience, what was fun, what was interesting, maybe some games you like there, and then other ideas you have about the overall feeling of Gen Con.
Sure, absolutely.
So you had a booth, right?
We had a booth. We were at the apex of the, you know where the booth twists over into Open Gaming? We were right next to that.
Perfect spot.
Yeah, it was really
good. Yeah, right on the edge. Get those hardcore gamers where they sit.
Backed up by North Star, so yeah.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Great gaming company.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there was some really fun stuff that came out of Gen Con. We talked about some of it in a previous episode, and I was working with Renegade, so they got unabashed, unsponsored, but might as well be sponsored content from us.
it's very true. We got to stop talking about it.
Yeah, so we can't talk about anything else, Renegade. They already got two episodes.
Fair enough.
But you and I were both kind of making the observation that there was nothing that was a standout hit. This is the one thing that everyone must play out of this Gen Con, right?
Yeah,
did you feel that way?
I think there was a lot of really interesting stuff. And there were a lot of games that I wanted to own, and there were a lot of games I wanted to play. But it didn't feel like there was a winner of Gen Con this year.
And it's felt that way in years past, you'd say?
It feels like that every once in a while. I think... you know, idea space is large, but it is colonized by a great many people.
Yeah.
And so it takes a little while, I think, for things to bubble up to the surface and be like truly monstrously great.
What's an example of something that has risen to that level in whatever year in the past decade?
Oh, well, before the show, we were talking about Gloomhaven. That's definitely one that did.
Yeah, that one definitely stood out.
Yeah, it was 2018 or 2017?
I 2017?
Recently.
It was in the last couple of years, yeah. And that one definitely took everybody sort of by storm. So
yeah.
Yeah.
So what were the top ones this year that were at least getting some buzz? Because they were all, you were saying previously that it was like a step up from an already established type of game.
Like,
right?
Everybody, so for example, CMON had a closed in booth. It took me a couple days to actually get close enough to see what was going on in it, because it was entirely enclosed except for a window.
Really?
And it turned out it's this thing called Tiburu. I think that's the name of it. Tiburu.
Okay.
And it's essentially a system they're building. I'm a little sad it's proprietary, actually, or it seems to be proprietary, where you put sensors on game pieces. And you have a sort of a neoprene style sensor mat. And so the app that goes along with it sort of keeps track of where all the pieces are.
Oh my God. When's Mansions of Madness going to release their new edition with that technology?
And so I sort of immediately went to the next step of application, which is what I want. I want to be able to see people building campaigns that are not already in existence. This so that
give them the building blocks kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. So I can use my set at home to play something I've never seen before and be surprised by the content, or possibly randomize stuff like the old XCOM game did.
Yeah.
You know, that's where that technology is really interesting, but you can see that's like, it's one step away. Like, it's this thing's really cool.
Well, this will be replicated at one point.
Wow.
This is interesting.
Well, maybe next year, Gen Con 2020, we're going to see everybody finding ways to take the technology that Tiburu has put out there and innovate on it.
Yeah,
so
hopefully.
That's a cool thing to look forward to.
Although, again, it's proprietary, so you know it'll probably be with CMON for a little while.
What their CMON employees, what Eric Lang dreams
hopefully up. Eric and his crew will come up with all that stuff. So.
Yeah, who is a genius mad scientist game designer.
Eric's amazing.
He's brilliant.
Yeah.
Absolutely brilliant. Yeah, and he's with CMON now, but he has designed for himself and for many other companies in the past.
Frequently, FFG.
Yeah.
I heard they were changing it back to CMON.
Are they?
I don't know. People used to say CMON, and then they were like, no, it's CMON. And before that, it was cool, mini,
doesn't
or not.
Doesn't CMON seem like an imperative?
Come on.
Or is that the
come
intent?
On.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think CMON.
Well,
I prefer
game.
CMON because that's what I call it now.
Right.
And also, CMON is like, get over
what
it.
Yeah, it can go a couple different ways,
whatever.
Right?
What is cool mini or not mean?
Well, they used to do lots of mini-based games.
They used to.
Well,
they started out as a forum for miniature like enthusiasts and like people who took apart and put miniatures back together in different ways and painted them and things like that. Huh. And they would have
like IKEA hacks.
Yeah.
For minis.
Exactly. Yeah.
I didn't know that. That's really cool.
Way back in the day, yeah.
So they started as a forum, and then they were like, well, maybe we should just make our own game around minis.
That's how I knew them anyway. Maybe there was another
mini way?
Yeah, exactly.
Come on. as someone who wasn't at Gen Con, actually, one of the ones that I had heard.
He was at Gen Can,
just
though.
Boo me. That was fun. I heard through the social media network a fair amount of buzz about Tapestry.
That was announced after Gen Con, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was announced, I think, a couple days after
really?
The show, or maybe just the day after.
Just a couple days after.
To be Rebels.
Jamie is that man, like, the way his brain works stuns me. You're in post decompressed Gen Con, but you're still paying attention, right?
Sure. Yeah, you're actually still actively paying attention because you want to see how your stuff played out,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And everyone is done and everyone's tired, but they're still got eyeballs on the internet. It's like, oh, here's one more announcement. Slide it right in.
That is
sneaky.
Okay.
It was really smart.
That is pretty cool.
That's Jamie,
Tapestry
Jamie
looks
Stegmeier
amazing.
Jamie of Stonemaier Games.
Yes.
Yeah, this is a worker placement, it looks like.
I'm not sure.
That's what my visual interpretation is.
Yeah, it's a Civ builder. Like, I don't know if it's fully 4X, but yeah, it is a slight worker placement along with some other mechanics. There's like some advancements tracks and other things
my,
like that.
My understanding that's of the crazy. Basic mechanic is that there are four tracks. There's like military and tech and a couple others, which I can't remember at the time. And your basic choice every turn is just choosing one of the four tracks to try and focus on.
Okay.
And then it has a variety of other knock-on effects.
So like there's kind of like a victory condition goal that you're going for is one of the tracks?
I think everything is, I think it's a little point salad-y. Like
okay.
Everything gives you a little
victory
bit
points.
Of
me
victory
love
points.
Point
yeah.
salad.
Well, as three people who haven't played it, I guess we shouldn't expand on it too much. Well, the
yeah,
reason
exactly.
I was mentioning
it's
it was like
yet, so.
I remember it being one of the few that stood out, but it's interesting that it was afterwards.
Right. I think that's one of the reasons it did stand out.
So
yeah.
Let's actually, sorry, I didn't mean to tangent us. Let's talk about.
Well, let me tangent us again to say another. you had an important. I want to say the other breakout that I had heard of and didn't get a chance to play was Parks by Keymaster Games designer Henry Audubon. And this is essentially, if you've ever played Tokaido.
I have played it.
Tokaido. Last place always moves next. Yeah.
I don't know if the movement mechanic is the same, but I heard that it had a similar feeling of you were exploring a national park, and it's more about the beauty of the game and exploration and the theme of travel and nature that is the thematic element. But players take on the role of two hikers as they trek through different trails across four seasons of the year. So this is one I'm really looking forward to checking out. It already has an 8 on Board Game Geek out of 10, which is very high.
Yeah, I haven't played it yet, but point of respect for that game. They're donating a percentage of their proceeds to park services.
Amazing.
Which is that's pretty great. Awesome.
Yes,
yeah.
Absolutely. Oh, I love that. That kind of is in lieu of, let me get none of the details right. So there is that committee of basically tech giants that is a government advisory board.
Mm-hmm.
And they this week announced that they want to sort of corporations are beholden to their shareholders above all else, but these big tech companies came together, and it may just be, you know, a showy thing that has no practical application, but they have put forth the idea that in the future, profits will not be the most important thing above all else. What's given to charity is important. How employees are treated is important. And sort of trying to shift the focus of America's corporate just mechanism to not always be profits are the most important thing, especially if we're going to do anything about climate change. So this guy, that political tangent, yes, but also in the vein of like, what a beautiful thing it is to, yes, you are a company making a game to make profits, but also giving people this gift of donating back to the national parks and giving a game that makes you appreciate the natural world.
Yeah. Full respect to those folks for that choice. That was just amazing.
Mad props. Jake, did you want to say anything?
No. Well, let's tie this together. So we're talking about these three games, for instance, that were the hits of, well, not hits. They were the highly regarded games of Gen Con. But we were saying earlier that nothing really like shot through like Gloomhaven or something like that did in previous years, right?
Yeah, it was really interesting. I walked the floor. I always, I'm looking for the next big thing. Mm-hmm. And there were quite a few. There was a little game cannot remember the name of it. It was in a tiny booth. But there was a little game that involved pucks that like lit up when they went under a central ring, and it was some kind of dexterity game.
Like hockey pucks, like air hockey?
Yeah.
Table hockey?
Yeah. And I was like, that looks interesting, but I couldn't get back to the booth before the end of the show, so I didn't have a chance to see it.
As sometimes happens.
Yeah. There's a lot of little things like that, but it wasn't like, I expected something like Shadow and Sixth World, the new edition, to be sort of all the talk at the show. And I heard a lot going in and a lot coming out, but not a lot at the show, and maybe that's just the format. Maybe role-playing games don't get
everybody's
quite
as... Well,
you can't experience the role-playing game at a booth fully.
Exactly.
You can't get a full grasp of, okay, I get what this is, because it requires a full session to really understand what that feels like.
Right, yeah.
And the nuances, especially if it's a new edition. But as you were saying, it's sort of like the trend we're seeing in television and film, where it's a continuation of a franchise more often than not.
Right.
Same with a lot of games. Lots of new additions or variations on an existing property.
Right. This is a worker placement game, and it's got a novel mechanic, but it's one thing, right? And it's not quite enough to say, hey, this is like a whole new quantum leap in gaming.
Or perhaps we've been spoiled by so much.
I think we really have.
Yeah. That our brains have become numb to some novelties or some degree of novelty that we're like, impress me more.
Yes.
Next thing.
can both be true?
Yes.
I think we are spoiled, and also like this still needs more innovation. Like we still need to keep going. Like the two things you mentioned in terms of like the magnets and also like the hockey pucks, like those are two innovations that people are trying. Now it's like putting them in a larger scale, maybe.
Yeah, let's see them do something really interesting with that. Yeah,
for sure. I think there's always room. Like, games are so flexible. The way we can do anything with pieces and put them in whatever order we want based on a rule, right?
Wherever we want. I ignore rules. I have pieces everywhere in the house. So even on the floor, decorating along with all the frames.
It's such an open design, right? Like, whereas like other forms are sometimes constrained, games can kind of be whatever they want because we're just asking people to commit to whatever rules we design.
Yeah, the circle.
So keep going.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, Patrick, thank you so much for coming on Victory Points today. Tell everybody what Crafty is up to and what they can look forward to coming from Crafty in the future, what you're up to and where to find you online.
Sure. So our home is crafty-games.com. And that's everything that we currently make is available or has sort of an information nexus there. If you're there and interested in upcoming stuff, definitely sign up for the newsletter, because that's where we're making most of our big announcements these days. There's a link for it right on the front page.
I hear something about metal dice?
Metal dice. That's the big thing. Yeah. So we talked about Mistborn at the beginning of the show and how it's all about metal. And we made some acrylic dice a while back, and people really like them. They're D6s that replace the six with a symbol from the magic alphabet from the world that Isaac Stewart built. And so we wound up partnering with Die Hard Dice, who are phenomenal. They're at dieharddice.com. I highly recommend you check out their stuff. But they are producing a 20 die all metal set for us. Unique finish and plating on every die.
Wow.
Unique symbol on every die. Half of them are pushing, so the numbers are depressed, and half of them are pulling, so the numbers are pulled up.
What?
Yeah.
Does that affect the way the dice rolled?
No, because there's a ring around the pulled up.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah,
I get you.
Yeah.
That's
so
cool.
It's still
flat
face.
Yeah.
We're prepping that. We're going to go to Kickstarter with that in about a month. So if you're interested in that,
that's
definitely
great.
Sign up for the newsletter.
Amazing. Okay, cool. Make sure you sign up for the Crafty newsletter. And can they find you on Twitter?
Yes. Twitter is crafty_games.
Awesome.
Yeah. Crafty with a...
With a C.
How it should be spelled, but
yes,
I don't know.
Like someone who can spell.
I don't know why
it.
I ever always picture Crafty with a K. I think it's because of Kraft Foods or something. I don't know, but
isn't that like a donut thing that starts
Krispy
with a K?
Krispy Kreme.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Krispy Kreme has Kraft made us all illiterate. All right, that's all the time we have on Victory Points. Say thank you so much for listening. If you like us and you want us to be your friend, all you have to do is rate us a 5. That's all we want.
And tell the world.
Oh, yeah, and tell your friends about us.
Yeah.
Okay, see you next time.
Bye.